would stop first.
Not I. Taitu peered in from the kitchen. Two other women looked over the upstairs rail. Our fellow diners stopped to watch. They were displaced people, just like us, and they understood all too well these kinds of reunions. These moments when a piece of your old house comes floating by in the river.
What are you doing here? Sige said. You mean you didn't come to see me?
I came to eat. I had no idea. I've been living in New York for 6 years. I'm here just for the day. I'm a doctor now, a surgeon.
A surgeon?
She gasped, falling back, clasping her hands to her heart. Then she kissed the back of my wrists, first one, then the other.
A surgeon! You brave, brave child!
She turned to our audience, and in the tones of a cantor, she continued, still in Amharic.
Listen, all you unbelievers! When he was a little boy, and when my baby was dying, who took me to the right place in the hospital? It was he. Who called the doctor, who was his father, to see my child? He did. Then who was it who stayed with me as my baby fought for life? No one but him. He was the only one by my side when my little baby died. No one else was there for me. If only you knew.
The tears streamed down her face, and in an instant, the mood in the room went from the joy of reunion to profound sadness, as if those two emotions were invariably linked. I heard sympathetic clucks and tisks from the men, and Taitu blew her nose and dabbed at her good eye, while the other two women wept freely. Sige was unable to speak, head bowed. She was overcome for a moment. At last, she straightened her shoulders, raised her head, the lips parted to smile bravely, and she declared,
I never ever forgot his kindness. Even today, when I go to sleep, I pray for my baby's soul, then I pray for this boy. I lived across the street. I watched him grow up, become a man, go to medical school. Now he is a surgeon. Taitu, give everyone their money back, for today is a feast day. Our brother has come home. Tell me, ye of little faith, does any one of you need some other proof that there is a God?
Her eyes glittered like diamonds. Her hands, palms up, reached for the ceiling. For the next few minutes, I solemnly shook the hand of every person in the house. Later, I sat with Sige on a sofa in a living room upstairs. She had kicked off her heels and tucked her feet up under her. Still holding my hand, she touched my cheek often to exclaim how happy she was to see me. I had plans to return to New York that afternoon, but Sige insisted on sending Mesfine away.
You can take a later flight, she said.
Are you sure I can find a taxi here? I said, pretending to be serious. After a beat, she threw her head back and laughed.
See, you have changed. You used to be so shy.
Through the window, I saw 6 or 7 baby goats in a large wire enclosure. Behind that was a chicken coop. A dreamy-looking boy with a long, narrow head sat stroking one of the goats.
He's my cousin, Sige said. You can see the forceps marks on his forehead. He has some problems, but he loves to take care of the animals. You should come here when we celebrate Meskel on Meskerem Day. We slaughter the goats and cook outdoors. You will see not just taxis, but police cars. They come from the Roxbury and Southend stations to eat.
Sige said she left Addis a few months after me. A patron of the bar, a corporal in the army, had wanted to marry her.
He was nobody, but in the revolution even the privates become powerful.
When she declined his advances, she was falsely accused of imperialist activities and imprisoned.
I bought my way out after 2 weeks. In the time I was in Kachele, they confiscated my house. He came to see me, pretending he had nothing to do with my arrest. If I married him, he said, everything would come back to us. The country was being run by dogs like him. I had money hidden away. I never looked back. I left. In Khartoum, I waited a year for asylum from the American embassy. I worked as a servant for the Hankins, a British family. They were nice. I learned English by taking care of their children. That was the only good thing that came out of Khartoum. I don't mind the cold in Boston because every cold day reminds me how good it is to be out of Khartoum. I worked hard here, Marion. Quick Mart. Often I did 2 shifts. Then 5 nights I worked at a parking garage. I saved and saved. I became the first Ethiopian woman to drive a taxi in Boston. I learned the city. I found work for Ethiopians. Stock boy, parking attendant, taxi driver, or counter girl at the hotel gift shop. I lent money on interest to Ethiopians. Taitu used to work for me in the bar, so when she came, I rented this house. She cooked. Then I bought a house. Now, my God, there is much to be done. Grind teff, make injera, clean chickens, make what, sweep the house. It takes 3 or 4 people. Ethiopians arrive at my door like newborn lambs, everything they have tied up in bedsheets, their x-rays still in their hands. I try to help them.
You really are the Queen of Sheba. There was an impish grin on her face. She switched to English, a language I had never heard her speak.
Marion, you know what I had to do to feed my baby in Addis.
Then in Sudan, I was even lower than that. I was no better than a barya, she said, using the slang word for slave. In America, they said you can be anything. I believed it. I worked hard. So when they say Queen of Sheba, I think to myself, yes, from barya to queen.
I told Sige about seeing her on the day I left Addis so hastily, seeing her getting out of her Fiat 850. Today, what do I see before I see your face? Your beautiful leg getting out of a car. The last glimpse of you in Addis was also your beautiful leg coming out of a car. I wanted to say goodbye to you then, but I couldn't. She laughed and self-consciously pulled her skirt down.
I knew you disappeared right after Genet, Sige said. No one knew if you were part of the hijacking.
Really? People thought I was an Eritrean guerrilla?
She shrugged.
I didn't think you had anything to do with it. But when I saw Genet, she never said anything one way or the other.
I was puzzled.
How could you have seen Genet? She left the same day I left. That's why I had to go.
Did you see her in Khartoum?
No, Marion. I saw her here.
You saw Genet in America?
I saw her here, in this house. Oh my God, you didn't know?
I felt the air leave my lungs. A sinkhole opened up under me.
Genet? Isn't she still fighting with the Eritreans? No, no, no. That girl came here as a refugee, just like the rest of us. Someone brought her here. She had her baby in her arms. She acted as if she didn't recognize me at first. I had to remind her.
Sige's face turned hard.
You know, Marion, once we come here, we are all the same. Eritrean, Amhara, Oromo, Big Shot, Barya, whatever status you had in Addis, it means nothing. In America, you begin at zero. The ones who do the best here are the ones who are zero there. But Genet came here thinking she was special, not like the rest of us.
When was this?
2, maybe 3 years ago? She said she'd lost touch with you. She didn't know where you went. She acted as if she didn't know you had escaped from Addis.
What?
She was lying, I said. It was the Eritreans who helped me escape. She was their star, their big heroine. She must have known. Maybe she didn't trust me, Marion. I never knew her the way I knew you, never exchanged 2 words with her. People change, you know. When you leave your country, you are like a plant taken out of soil. Some people turn hard, they can't flower again.
I remember she told me she got sick in the field. She got sick of the fighting, too, I think. She had the baby. Some women she knew in New York had a job for her and offered to help take care of the baby boy. So I didn't really have to do anything for her.
My God, I said, sinking back into the sofa. I was glad I didn't know of this before. Glad I didn't know she was in New York. Is she still there?
No.
Sige hesitated, as if she wasn't sure whether to tell me the rest.
There were lots of rumors. What I heard is, she met a man, and they got married. Something happened. She almost killed him. I don't know exactly why or how. All I know is that she's in prison. Her baby was given up for adoption.
Sige saw the shock on my face.
I'm sorry. I thought you knew all this. I could find out if she is still in jail.
No. I shook my head. You don't understand. I don't want to ever see her again. I said. I don't want to see her other than to spit in her face, I thought.
But she was your own sister.
No, don't say that, I said sharply. We sat there in silence. If Sige found my reaction unexpected, I couldn't blame her. I had to wait a few minutes for the turmoil in me to subside. Sige, I said at last, reaching for her hand. I'm sorry. I must explain. You see, Genet was not my sister. She was the love of my life. Sige was shocked.
You were in love with your own sister?
She's not my sister!
I'm sorry, of course.
What does it matter, Sige? If she was my sister or not my sister, either way I was in love with her. I couldn't change what I felt for her. We were going to marry after we finished medical school.
What happened?
My own brother betrayed me. She betrayed me. This was so hard to say. They were pillows for each other, I said, using an Amharic expression. I realized I'd just told Sige what I'd never told anyone else, not even Hema. I'd come close to telling Thomas Stone in the restaurant, but I hadn't. There was such relief now in the telling. I left nothing out, my being falsely accused, Genet's genital mutilation, Rosina's death, Hema's suspicion that I was responsible. In 6 years at Our Lady of Perpetual Succor, with all the close friends I had made, Deepak, BC, various medical students, not one of them had I told this tale. Sige's hand was over her mouth, her eyes showing her astonishment and empathy. After a while, she put her hand down and shook her head sadly.
Your brother wanted to sleep with me, Sige said.
She grinned when she saw my jaw drop.
Oh, yes. You both were young then, 14 or 15. Not too young, though. Shiva was so direct. How much to sleep with you?
She laughed at the audacity of this, gazing out of the window, her mind conjuring up that faraway time. Did he? I said at last, my throat so dry that the words could have set fire to the dage in my stomach. She had no idea how important her answer was to me.
Did he what?
Sleep with you.
Oh, you sweet thing. No.
She pinched my cheek.
You should see your expression. No, no.
I let out the breath I had been holding.
Don't you know that if it had been you, it would have been different? If you'd ever asked. I owe you, Marion. I still owe you.
I was sure I was blushing. As quickly as Genet had appeared in my head, she had disappeared. You don't owe me anything, Sige. And I'm sorry I never should have asked you that. It's personal. Your business.
Marion, you must have lots of girlfriends. A surgeon in New York. How many nurses share your pillow, eh? Where are you going?
Why are you standing? What's the matter?
Sige, it's late. I'd better... She pulled me down firmly, so that I landed almost on top of her. She held me. The scent of her body and of her perfume had shot up my nostrils. My eyes were on her throat, her chin, her bosom. I had thought of her many a night in the house staff quarters at Our Lady of Perpetual Succor, never imagining that I might really touch her. I was a board-certified general surgeon, but now I felt like a pimply adolescent.
You are turning so red. Are you all right? Oh, bless me, Mary, blessed Gabriel and the saints. You are still a virgin, aren't you?
I nodded sheepishly.
Why are you crying? I asked.
She would only shake her head, studying my face while swiping at her eyes. At last, holding my cheeks in her hands, she said,
I am crying because it's so beautiful.
It isn't beautiful, Sige. It's stupid.
No, it's not, she said.
I saved myself for Genet. Yes, I know, ridiculous. But then when she and Shiva... I threw myself into my studies. The worst part is, I still loved her. Shiva didn't. I loved her. I felt responsible when she almost died. Can you believe that? Shiva slept with her, and I felt responsible. Then, when she and her friend stole that plane, she betrayed me again. She never worried what might happen to me, or Hema, or Shiva. But at least at that moment, on the day I left Ethiopia, I was free of her. When I came here, I tried to forget her. I hoped she was dead in that stupid war. Her damn war. Now I find she's here. Maybe I should leave the country, Sige, go to Brazil or India. I don't want to be on the same continent as that woman.
Stop it, Marion. Don't talk foolishly. How much stage did you drink? This is a big country, and you're a big man. Forget about her. Look where you are, and look where she is. She's in jail, for God's sake.
She touched my hair, and then she pulled me to her bosom.
You are the kind of man that women dream about.
I was aroused. There was nothing about my life that I could hide from her, even if I wanted to. Not my shame, not my secrets, not my embarrassment. She kissed me on my lips, a brief exploratory brush first, then a leisurely probing kiss. I could feel the adrenaline pouring out of me, the reserves of unused stockpiled testosterone announcing their availability. So this is how it is going to happen, I thought. On the day I pass my surgical boards. How fitting. My hands reached for her. She sighed and pulled back, pushing me upright, then straightening her hair. Her expression was serious, like that of a clinician making a pronouncement after the detailed physical exam.
Wait, my Marion. You've saved yourself all these years. That is not a small thing. I want you to go home. After you have thought about it, if you want me, I will be here. You can come back here, or we can go away, go on a trip together. Or I will come to New York, and we will take a beautiful hotel room.
She read the disappointment on my face, the rejection.
Don't be sad. I am doing this out of love for you. When you have something this precious, you must think carefully how you give it away. I'll understand if you don't give it to me. If you choose me, I will be honored, and I will honor you. Now I'll get a taxi to take you. Go, my sweet man. Go with God. There is no one else like you.
This is my life, I thought, as my taxi slogged through heavy traffic and inched through the tunnel to Logan Airport. I have excised the cancer from my past, cut it out. I have crossed the high plains, descended into the desert, traversed oceans, and planted my feet in new soil. I have been the apprentice, paid my dues, and have just become master of my ship. But when I look down, why do I see the ancient, tarred, mud-stained slippers that I buried at the start of the journey still stuck to my feet? Chapter 50. Slit the Thew. Now that I had the income of an attending surgeon, I bought a duplex at one end of a row of such units in Queens. The roof line above the dormer window on one side was peaked like an eyebrow, and it cast a proprietary gaze over an overgrown wedge of land thick with maples. In summer, I put my jasmine pots on the little patio, and I grew salad staples in a tiny garden. In winter, I brought the jasmine indoors, while the empty wire cages outside stood as memorials to the succulent, blood-red tomatoes the earth had given up. I painted walls, I repaired roof shingles, I installed bookshelves. Uprooted from Africa, I was satisfying a nesting impulse. I'd found my version of happiness in America. 6 years had gone by, and though I should have visited Ethiopia, somehow I could never quite break free. One day, when coming out of an ice cream shop, a tall, elegantly dressed black woman, her leather coat dancing above her ankles, brushed past me. I held the door for her, and as she slid past, an intense disquiet came over me. She turned back to look at me, smiling. Another evening, while driving back through Manhattan from a trauma conference in New Jersey, a streetwalker caught my eye as she stepped out from under an awning near the Holland Tunnel. She was ghost-lit by car headlamps and reflections off the puddles. She tit-flashed me in the rain, or I imagined she did. I felt the disquiet again, like the hint of something afire, but one doesn't know where. I circled the block, but she was gone. At home, I prepared for the next day's work. I could have gone into private practice when I finished my 5-year residency, or else I could have gone to some other teaching institution. But I felt a great loyalty to Our Lady. And now, Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio and Walter Reed in Washington were sending us a few of their senior surgical residents. In peacetime, we provided the closest thing to a war zone, a place where they could hone their skills. I was Our Lady's head of trauma. We were blessed with new resources and more personnel. There was no reason for me to be unhappy. But that night, with a fire going in the grate, I felt restless, as if a paralysis would soon set in if I didn't take certain measures. That weekend, I decided my life needed a dimension that did not involve work. I looked over the times for events, readings, openings, plays, lectures, and other matters of interest. I forced myself to leave the house on Saturday and again on Sunday. The following Friday, I came home after work and deposited my briefcase and the mail in my library. In the kitchen, I lit the candle, set the table, and warmed up the last portion of a chicken casserole that I had cooked the previous Sunday from a Times recipe. There was a knock on the door. I panicked. Had I invited someone over for dinner and forgotten? Other than Deepak coming over once, no one had ever been here. Could it be that Sige from Boston had decided to take matters into her own hands, since I had failed to call her? I picked up the receiver a dozen times and then lost courage. Or could this be Thomas Stone knocking? I hadn't told him where I lived, but he could have found out easily from Deepak. I looked through the peephole. In that convex fisheye image, I saw eyes, a nose, cheekbones, lips. My brain tried to juggle and rearrange the parts to come up with a face and a name. It wasn't Stone, or Deepak, or Sige. There was no mistaking who it was. She turned to leave, went down the 2 steps. I could have watched her walk away. I opened the door. She stood frozen, her body facing the street, her face turned back to the door. She was taller than I recalled, or perhaps it was that she was thinner. She looked to see that it was me. Then she dropped her gaze to a spot near my left elbow. This allowed me to study her at will, to decide whether to slam the door on her. Her hair was straightened, lank, without benefit of ribbons or bows or even a good combing. The cheekbones were intact, more prominent than ever, as if to better buttress those oval, slanting eyes which were her prettiest feature. Even without makeup, hers would always be a stunning face. Although it was summer, she wore a long wool coat tied tight around the waist, and she hugged herself as if she were cold. She stood there motionless, like a small animal caught invading the territory of a predator, paralyzed and unable to move. I came down my steps. I reached my hand out and tilted her face up. Her eyeballs and lids rolled down just like the eyes of the doll she used to play with. Her skin was cold to my touch. The vertical scars at the outer edges of her eyes were now seasoned lines, though I recalled the day Rosina's blade gave birth to them, and how they had been raw and choked with dark blood. I jerked her chin farther up. Still, she wouldn't meet my gaze. I wanted her to see the scars on my body, one from her betrayal of me with Shiva, and another from her becoming more Eritrean than any Eritrean, resulting in the hijacking that drove me out of my country. I wanted her to see my rage through my outer calm. I wanted her to feel the blood surge in my muscles, to see the way my fingers curled and coiled and itched for her windpipe. It was good she didn't look, because if she'd so much as blinked, I would have bit into her jugular, I would have consumed her bones, teeth, and hair, leaving nothing of her on the street. I took her by the elbow and led her inside. She came like a woman going to the gallows. In the foyer, as I bolted the door, she stood rooted to the mat. I led her to my library, a dining room that I had transformed, and I pushed her down on the ottoman. She perched on its edge. I stared down at her. She didn't move. Then she coughed, a spasm that took 15 seconds to pass. She brought a crumpled tissue to her lips. I looked at her for a long time. I was about to speak when the cough commenced again. I went to the kitchen. I boiled water for tea, leaning my head against the refrigerator as I waited. Why was I doing this? 1 minute homicide, the next minute tea? She had not changed her position. When she took the cup from me, I saw her unvarnished, chipped fingernails and the wrinkled washerwoman's skin. She pulled one sleeve down, passed the cup over, and repeated the process with the other so as to hide her hands. Tears streamed down her face, her lips pulled back into a grimace. I had hoped that my heart would be hardened to such displays.
"Sorry, I work in the kitchen," she whispered.
"After all you have done to me, you're sorry about the state of your hands?" She blinked, said nothing. "How did you find me?"
"Sige sent me."
"Why?"
"I called her when I got out of jail. I needed help."
"Didn't she tell you that I didn't want to see you?"
"Yes, but she insisted I see you before she would help me."
She glanced directly at me for the very first time.
"And I wanted to see you."
"Why?"
"To tell you I'm sorry."
She averted her gaze after a few seconds. "Is that something you learn in prison? Avoiding eye contact?" She laughed, and in that moment I wondered if, with all she had seen and done, she was beyond being touched by anger. She said, "I was stabbed once for looking." She pointed down with her chin to her left side. "They took out my spleen." "Where were you in prison?"
"Albany."
"And now?"
"I'm paroled. I have to see my probation officer every week."
She put her cup down. "What else did Sige say?"
"That you're a surgeon."
She looked around the library, the shelves full of books.
that you're doing well?
I'm only here because I was forced to run, forced to leave in the night like a thief. You know who did that to me? To Hema? It was someone who was to our family like a daughter.
She rocked back and forth.
Go on, she said, straightening her back. I deserve it.
Still playing the martyr? I heard you hid a gun in your hair when you got on that plane. An afro. You were the Angela Davis of the Eritrean cause, right?
She shook her head. After a long while, she said,
I don't know what I was. I don't know who I was. The person I was felt she had to do something great.
She spat out the last word.
Something spectacular.
For Zumui.
For me. They promised me that you and our family would not be harmed. As soon as the hijack was over, I realized how stupid it was. Nothing about it was great. I was a great fool, that's all.
She drank her tea. She stood up.
Forgive me, if you can. You deserved better.
Shut up and sit down, I said.
She obeyed.
You think that does it? You say sorry and then leave?
She shook her head.
You had a baby? I said. A field baby.
The contraceptives they gave us didn't work.
Why did you go to jail?
Must I tell you everything?
She began coughing again. When the spasm was over, she shivered, although the room was warm and I was sweating.
What happened to your baby?
Her face crumpled. Her lips stretched out. Her shoulders shook.
They took my baby away from me. Gave him away for adoption. I cursed the man who put me in that position. Cursed that man.
She looked up.
I was a good mother, Marion.
A good mother? I laughed. If you were a good mother, you might be carrying my child.
She smiled through her tears as if I were being funny. As if she'd just remembered my fantasy of our getting married and populating missing with our children. Then she began to shake, and at first I thought she was crying or laughing, but I heard her teeth chatter. I had rehearsed my lines in my head as I walked out of Asmara, walked all the way to the Sudan. I'd rehearsed them so many times since. I imagined every excuse she might offer if I ever met her. I had my barbs ready. But this quaking, silent adversary was not what I'd envisioned. I reached over and felt her pulse, 140 beats per minute. Her skin, cool just a while ago, was burning to the touch.
I must go,
she said, rising but swaying.
No, you will stay.
She was clearly unwell. I gave her 3 aspirin. I led her into the master bath and ran the shower. When it was steaming, I helped her undress. If earlier I had seen her as an animal in the predator's lair, now I felt like a father disrobing his child. Once she was in the shower, I tossed her underwear and shirt into the washer and ran the load. I helped her out of the shower. She was on glass legs. I dried her off and sat her on the edge of the bed. I put a pair of my winter flannels on her and tucked her in. I made her eat a few spoons of casserole and drink more tea. I put Vicks on her throat and on her chest and the soles of her feet, just as Hema would do with us. She was asleep before I slid the woolen socks over her toes. What was I feeling? This was a Pyrrhic victory. A pyrexic victory. The thermometer I slid under her armpit read 103 degrees. While she slept, I moved her wet clothes to the dryer and stuck her jeans in the washer. I put away the casserole. Then I sat in the library by myself, trying to read. Perhaps I dozed. Hours later, I heard the sound of a toilet being flushed. She was on the bed, covers thrown to the side, pajamas and socks off, wrapped in a towel and wiping her brow with a washcloth. Her fever had broken. She moved over to make room for me.
"Do you want me to leave now?" she said.
In that question, I felt that she was taking control because there was only one possible answer. "You're sleeping here."
"I'm burning up," she said.
I changed into my boxers and t-shirt in the bathroom, took a blanket from the wardrobe and headed for the library.
"Stay with me," she said. "Please?"
I had no reply planned for that. I climbed into my bed. When I reached for the light, she said,
"Please, leave it on."
No sooner had I lain down than she pressed against me, smelling of my deodorant, my shampoo and Vicks. She raised my arm and huddled in the crook of my shoulder, her damp body against me. Her fingers touched my face very gingerly, as if she worried that I might bite. I remembered that night so many years ago when I found her naked in the pantry.
"What's that sound?" she said, startled.
"It's the dryer alarm. I washed your clothes." I heard her sniffle, then sob.
"You deserved better," she said, looking up.
"Yes, I did." I stared at her eyes, remembering the little fleck in the right iris and the puff of grey around it, where a spark had penetrated. Yes, it was still there, darker now, looking like a blemish she was born with. I traced her lips, her nose. She shut her lids at my touch. Tears were sliding underneath them. She smiled a smile from our days of innocence. I took my hand away. She opened her lids, her eyes glistening. Hesitantly, she kissed my lips. No, I hadn't forgotten. At that moment, my anger wasn't so much with her as it was with the passage of time. Time had robbed me of such wonderful illusions, taken them away far too soon. But right then, I wanted the illusion that she was mine. She kissed me again, and I tasted the salt of her tears. Was she feeling sorry for me? I couldn't take that. Ever. Suddenly, I was on top of her, tearing away the sheet, tearing away her towel, clumsy but determined. She was startled, the muscles of her neck taut like cables. I grabbed her head and kissed her.
"Wait," she whispered. "Shouldn't you?"
But I was already inside her. She winced. "Shouldn't I what, Gennet?" I said as I bucked, my pelvis possessing some intrinsic knowledge of the movements needed.
"This is my first time," I managed to say. "I wouldn't know what I should or shouldn't do." Her pupils dilated. Was she pleased to learn this about me?
Now she knew. Now she knew that there were people in this world who kept their promises. Gauche, whose deathbed she never had the time to visit, was one such person. I wanted the knowledge to shame her, to terrify her. When it was over, I stayed on top of her.
"My first time, Gennet," I said softly. "Don't think that's because I was waiting for you. It's because you fucked my life up. You could have counted on me. Money in the bank, as they say here. And what did you do? You turned it all into shit. I wanted to make life beautiful for you. I don't understand it really, Gennet. You had Hema and Gauche. You had Missing. You had me, who loved you more than you will ever love yourself." She wept under me. After a long time, she gently caressed my head, tried to kiss me. She said, "I need to go to the bathroom."
I ignored her. I was aroused again. I began to move inside her once more.
"Please, Marion," she said.
Without removing myself from within her, I rolled onto my back, holding her, flipping her, and setting her on top of me, her breasts hovering over me. "You need to pee? Go ahead," I said, my breath coming quick. "You've done that before, too." I grabbed her shoulders and pulled her to me hard. I smelled her fever, the scent of blood and sex and urine. I came again. Then I let go. I let her slide off. I woke late on Saturday morning to find her back in the crook of my arm, staring at me. I took her again. I couldn't imagine how I had denied myself this pleasure for so long. When I awoke, it was 2 p.m., and I could hear her in the kitchen. I went to the bathroom. It was when I returned to the bed that I saw the blood on the sheets. I stripped the bed and took the sheets to the washing machine. She brought 2 cups of coffee, a serving of the casserole, and 2 spoons to me. She was getting feverish again, the dressing gown not warm enough, her teeth chattering, and with spasms of a dry cough. I took the coffee from her. Her dressing gown came apart. She watched me remake the bed. "Sorry," she said. "I am bleeding because the scars... I always bleed with intercourse. Rosina's gift to me. So that I will always think of her when... Is it painful?" "At first, and if it's been a long time." "What about this fever? How long have you been this way? Have you had an X-ray?" "I'll be fine," she said. "It's a bad cold. Hope I don't give it to you. I took some Advil I found in your cabinet."
"Genet, you should..."
"Really, I'll be fine, doctor." "Tell me why you went to prison."
Her smile disappeared. She shook her head.
"Please, Marion, don't."
I knew then it was a story that would do me no good. I knew I had to hear it. Later, when the two of us were seated in my library, I insisted. He was an intellectual, a firebrand, an Eritrean who, like her, had left the cause. He shall remain nameless. It's painful enough already. Suffice it to say, he won the heart of her baby. The baby's father had died in the struggle. And then he won her heart. All this in New York, after her arrival. She felt her life was just beginning. They married. In a year she was pregnant with his child. She began to suspect that he was cheating on her. She found the whereabouts of the woman, the flat where they conducted their tryst. She broke in and hid in the woman's clothes closet and waited there for half a day till the couple arrived in the late afternoon. When her husband and his white lover were on her bed, seeking carnal knowledge of each other in a noisy, effortful way, Genet debated whether to announce her presence.
"Marion," she said, "as I stood in that closet, with this woman's belts and baskets like snakes at my feet, it all came back to me. Everything I had been through from the time of Zemui's death till then. I somehow came to America, and what did I do? For the first time in my life, for the one person who deserved it the least, I gave my love completely. I loved him. What is it you said earlier? More than I loved myself. I gave it all up for this useless man. Standing in the closet, I knew that if I tried to get vengeance, I had to be willing to lose my life. There has only been one man in my life worthy of such a sacrifice, Marion, and it was you. I was too stupid to know that when I was young. I was too stupid. He wasn't worth it, but now I couldn't stop myself. You see, in loving him, it had happened again, Marion. I wanted to be great. I thought he was destined for greatness as an academic, as an intellectual, and my greatness would be in being with him. For the first time, I understood who was the proletariat. The proletariat was me.
the proletariat had always been me, and now I needed to act for the proletariat. I had my straight razor in my hand. I began to sing in my softest voice. They could not see me, though I could see them. I opened the door of the closet with one intention for him, to slit his tongue, slit it like a stalk of henna. You can only do that when you have loved someone so completely that you have held nothing back and there is nothing left of you. It has all been used. Do you understand? I understood all too well. Otherwise, I'd have said to her, take him and keep him, good riddance. Instead, I jumped on them. I cut them, but not as badly as I had in mind. They escaped. I waited for the police. I felt as if I had taken off handcuffs that had been on my wrists the whole time. I had been looking for greatness, and I found it then. I was free at the very moment when my freedom would end. She saw my expression as I followed the story, and she smiled. Genet died in prison, Marion. Genet is no more. When they take your living child away, you die, and the child growing inside you dies too. All the things that matter are gone, and so I am dead. There was a tiny part of me that wanted to say, you have me, Genet. But for once, I stopped to consider myself, to save myself. I felt compassion for her of a sort that I hadn't felt before. It was a feeling better than love, because it released me. It set me free of her. Marion, I said to myself, she found her greatness at last, found it in her suffering. Once you have greatness, who needs anything else?
Chapter 51. The Devil's Choice. In retrospect, my illness began that Sunday morning in the crystalline moment of waking to a silent house in which I knew I was alone and she was gone. 43 days later, the first shudder of nausea arrived, an ocean surge as if a distant Vesuvius had collapsed into the sea. Next, an ancient fog, an intoto mist full of shifting shapes and animal sounds descended on me, and by the 49th day I had lost consciousness. How remarkable that a life should turn on such a small thing as a decision to open a door or not. I ushered Genet in on a Friday. She let herself out 2 days later without a goodbye, and nothing would be the same again. She placed a pinwheel cross at the center of the dining table, a gift for me, I presumed. That St. Bridget's medallion she wore on a necklace had been her father's, and it had belonged to a Canadian soldier named Darwin before that. The tale of her ex-husband lingered like a nasty flu. I'd insisted on hearing the story. I discovered that Genet was capable of selfless love, just not with me. Still, in my home I'd found a momentary equilibrium with her, or the illusion of it, as if we were again like children playing house, playing doctor. I hurried home each night after work, hoping to find her waiting on my stoop. My heart would sink when I glimpsed the yellow sticky I had left for her inside the screen door, telling her the key was with my good neighbor, Holmes, and to feel at home. Once inside, I felt compelled to retrieve my note, checking to be sure I had, in fact, written on it. I confess, I even left the stub of a pencil by the door in case she felt inclined to compose a reply. By Friday, a week after I first dragged her into my home, the sight of that yellow square of paper screamed fool. The stubby pencil said, fool of the highest order. I tore up the paper and flung the pencil stub into the street. I wasn't angry with Genet. She was consistent, if nothing else. I was angry with myself because I still loved her,
or at least I loved that dream of our togetherness. My feelings were unreasonable, irrational, and I couldn't change them. That hurt. Sitting in my library that night, having done more damage to a bottle of Pinch in 4 hours than I had in the year since I bought it, I replayed our last exchange. She'd been curled up in the chair I now sat in, wearing my dressing gown, the gown that I now wore. I came to her with tea, that signature move of fools, one of the stigmata by which you shall know us.
Marion,
she said, for she had been gazing at my library, my eclectic little collection.
Your father's apartment in Boston, the way you described it, it sounds so much like this.
Don't be ridiculous, I said. I built these bookcases myself. Half the books here have nothing to do with surgery. Surgery isn't my life. She didn't argue. We sat quietly. At one point, I saw her gaze flit to the rug on the floor between us. There was an intruder sitting naked on those synthetic fibers, a dark, silent man with razor cuts to his body. His presence put a damper on our conversation. When I announced I was going to bed, she said she'd be right along. She smiled. I didn't believe her. I thought I'd never see her again. But I was wrong. She joined me under the covers. We made love. It was tender and slow. It was the very moment when I thought, at last, she's going to stay. But in fact, it was her goodbye. 2 weeks after she left, I felt at odds with my house. I found my library oppressive. In the kitchen, I took out my dinner, which was a foil packet labeled Friday in my handwriting. It was the last of what I had cooked, frozen, and packed in aliquots many weekends ago. Now I saw this categorizing of my freezer food as a sign of the true chaos inside my head. Thank God for my good neighbor, Sonny Holmes. He heard me raging. He heard me bang my head against the fridge. Sonny Holmes had an inherent curiosity, an honest all-American nosiness that came with crossing 170th year, and that did not try to conceal itself. He'd been aware of the coming of my guest, such a rare event, and he'd heard the headboard music and then the long silence.
"You need to hire a security firm,"
he said, coming to a quick diagnosis before I had even finished my story. Sonny believed in the Enneagram, that Jesuit-invented classification of people into personality types. He was a one, willful and confident and certain. He had pegged me as a 3 or a 4, or was it a 2? Whatever it was a number that did not argue with ones. "I need a what?" I said.
"A private detective."
"Sonny, for what? I don't want to see her again."
"Perhaps so, but you need closure. What if she's in jail or in a hospital? What if she's trying desperately to get back to you, but can't?"
A noble motive. That was all a 2 needed to continue an obsession. I latched on to that. East Coast investigations of Flushing turned out to be an earnest blonde youth by the name of Appleby, son of Holmes' late sister-in-law. Appleby quickly established that Gennett had not returned to her halfway house. She hadn't gone to Nathan's restaurant where she washed dishes. She had not checked in with her probation officer, and she had not called Sige. He learned these facts in no time. He even knew that Gennett had been diagnosed with tuberculosis while in prison. She began medications, but then failed to report for her DOT, directly observed therapy after she was released. The cough, the fever, in all likelihood, were her tuberculosis coming back. The disconcerting news was that if she ever materialized, I'd be third in line after the state health department and her probation officer. She would be headed back to jail. Appleby's source in jail could get his hands on her complete medical records if we wished, and Appleby said he'd taken the liberty of telling the man to proceed. I was concerned about violating her confidentiality.
"Knowledge is power in these kinds of situations,"
Appleby added, and with that he won me over. Any man who would use a quote that Ghosh loved was a man to trust.
You're paying to know, he added, and I think we're obliged to know more.
So what now? I asked Appleby. I wasn't asking him about exposure to tuberculosis. I could handle that. Appleby avoided my eyes. His cheeks and the tip of his nose were covered with twitchy blood vessels, ready to flush at the least provocation. His condition was acne rosacea, not to be confused with the pedestrian acne vulgaris, the bane of many teenagers. Appleby's nose would one day be burgundy and bulbous, the cheeks a meaty red. Already shy, his problems would get worse because strangers would assume incorrectly that his appearance was a result of drink. Here I knew about his future while paying him to tell me mine.
Well, Dr. Stone, Appleby said, clearing his throat, his nose starting to redden, a sure indication that I would not like what he had to say. Respectfully, I would say to check your silverware. Inventory your belongings. Make sure nothing is missing.
I looked at him for a long while.
But, Mr. Appleby, the only thing that matters to me is precisely the one thing that is missing.
Yes, of course, he said. The compassion in his voice told me he had known my kind of pain. There are legions of us. As far as the events of the next few weeks, I recall one night waking to the shrill ring of the telephone. Receiver in hand, I was lost, uncertain whether I was at Our Lady or back at Missing. I was the backup trauma consultant, but I couldn't decipher what the resident at the other end wanted. This isn't uncommon for the first 10 seconds of a middle-of-the-night conversation. The caller understands. But, as we kept talking, the fog in my brain refused to lift. I hung up. I pulled the phone from its moorings. The next morning, my mind felt clear, but my body wouldn't rise off the bed. I was weak. The thought of food turned my stomach. I rolled over and went back to sleep. Perhaps the same day, perhaps a few days later, a man was on the edge of my bed. He took my pulse, called my name. It was my former chief resident and now my colleague at Our Lady, Deepak Jesudas. I desperately held his hand and asked him not to leave. I must have recognized the danger of my situation.
I'm not leaving, he said, just pulling back the curtain.
My memory is that I told him everything that had transpired. He examined me as I spoke. He pulled down my eyelids, interrupting me only to ask that I look down at my feet, or say, ah. At one point, he inquired if I had a stethoscope in the house. I said, are you kidding? I'm a surgeon. And we laughed together, a strange sound that had been missing from my home. I said ouch when he probed just under my ribs on the right. I found this funny. I heard him murmuring on the telephone. All the while, I did not let go of his hand. 3 men whose faces I knew arrived with a stretcher. They wrapped me in a flannel cocoon, carried me out to the curb, and lifted me up into their ambulance. I remember wanting to say something about the beauty of their motion, the inherent grace, and how incredible it was, this baby kangaroo in pouch feeling. I apologized for not having appreciated their skills all these years. Deepak rode with me. At Our Lady, he walked alongside my gurney, past the shocked faces of the staff we encountered in the halls and elevator. He wheeled me into the intensive care unit of Our Lady of Perpetual Succor. My eyes glowed yellow under the harsh fluorescent lights, but I didn't know it. My skin, too. I bled wildly from every needle stick. Too late, the nurses tried to hide the ominous tea-colored urine in my catheter bag from me, but I saw. For the first time, I was very, very scared. The increasing swelling in my brain made me desperately sleepy. I held on to consciousness long enough to ask Deepak to come near.
Whatever happens, I whispered, don't take me from Our Lady. If I must die and can't die at Missing, I want to die here.
At some point, I was aware that Thomas Stone came to my bedside and was studying me.
but not with the concern of a clinician. It was the petrified look I knew so well, the look of a parent whose child had suffered some misfortune.